Shrink Wrap Radio number 554, Sexual Abuse Recovery Coaching with Rachel Grant.
It's Shrink Wrap Radio. All the psychology you need to know and just enough to make it dangerous. It's all in your head. And now here's your host, Dr. Dave.
On today's show, I'll be speaking with Rachel Grant, MA, who is a sexual abuse recovery coach. Since 2007, she's offered her program, Beyond Surviving, which has been specifically designed to change the way clients think about and heal from sexual abuse. For more information about Rachel Grant, please see our show notes at shrinkwrapradio.com. Rachel Grant, welcome to Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you so much. Glad to be here.
Well, it's good to have you on the show. And I want to start out by asking you, how did you come to work with sexual abuse?
Well, so my path to this work that I do today was a little bit wiggly. It didn't start out as a very strong intention, like this is what I'm going to do.
Sounds like life.
That's how sounds life like works. Life, doesn't yeah. it? We find our way to places, exactly.
Yeah.
Oh my goodness. So when I was in college, my intention really was to be a high school English teacher. And along the way, I started to, you know, get more interested in child development and went on to work as a nanny for many, many years. And then as those children were kind of reaching a place where they might not need a nanny as much, I was kind of thinking, well, what's next? And I was at a very particular place in my own healing journey. I had really, as a result of sexual abuse that I experienced at the hands of my grandfather, my main memories are like around the age of 10. I had done some healing work, but had mostly kind of tried to pretend that there was no problem, right? Like many survivors of abuse do. And I was just out of a divorce from a 10-year relationship that was abusive as well. And really thinking about, you know, what's next? And gosh, do I really want to keep repeating these patterns and staying in like all of this stuff that's there as a result of the abuse? And so something kind of switched in me at that point where I thought, you know, I don't really want to just kind of keep getting by and surviving my life. I'd really like to live it and be free of all this junk.
Right.
But I started to notice that like the books I was reading and the groups I was attending, the therapists I was working with, like none of them were really helping me bridge that gap from understanding myself and understanding the behaviors that were there to actually making change. And
can I dig in a little bit
more? Yeah, of course.
You say you wanted to get past all that junk.
Yeah.
And I'm wondering, psychologically, emotionally, what were you aware of as issues or problems that were getting in the way?
Well, I really noticed that I was immature emotionally. That was something that really became clear for me in that 10-year relationship. You know, there was, of course, the abuse to be dealing with, which has all of those layers of feeling like you're not deserving or lovable or worth anything better. So that self-esteem piece and lack of confidence piece. Mm-hmm. But there was also this part of me that still felt very young. Like I would really respond almost like a 12-year-old to situations. You know, I didn't have that emotional maturity. I was very successful in my life, right? Like I had a job and managed to get things done. And so on one level, I was, you know, fine. But on this relational level, I didn't know how to trust. I was very poor at communication. My emotions were, oh my gosh, like just all over the place, you know, mm-hmm. from rage, like extreme rage to depression, just this roller coaster ride, right?
Okay.
And I had lots of deep insights as to why those things were happening, right?
Yeah.
Like where all the fears were and where all the patterning came from.
Were you always aware and remembering the abuse by your grandfather, or was that repressed to some degree? What about that?
So I was, when my grandfather came to live with my family when I was 5 years old, and the first, what I call conscious memory of abuse happened when I was 10. About 3 or 4 years ago, when I was doing some kind of deep inner child work and looking at some different aspects of my journey, there were some memories from younger, like 5 or 6, but they're very, you know, as you know, like sometimes abuse memories are not very clear. but I do have a sense that something happened when I was younger as well. But my most conscious memories start at the age of 10. And then, you know, there are moments of abuse from the time the abuse started in that series at 10.
Yeah. So you were carrying that awareness with you at 11, 12, 13 and so on. And it was always there somewhere in the background.
Yeah, very much so. Uh-huh.
And then you did go into various kinds of therapy.
I did when I was in my 20s. My parents, when they discovered that my grandfather was abusing me, they were great. You know, they immediately got him out of the house.
Oh, good.
And I'm really thankful for that because, you know, now having worked with, you know, survivors of abuse for 10 plus years, you know, hundreds of stories of people not receiving that kind of support, and that just adds a whole other layer, right, of healing that we need to do. And my parents wanted me to go to counseling. I did go see one counselor one time, but unfortunately had what is a too common experience of the counselor saying things like, "What were you wearing? Do you think that because you were wearing that?" Like, you know, asking those sorts of questions. And
that
so
sort of imply that you're the, not the victim, but the, that you brought it on somehow.
Yeah. Yeah. Exactly. So I guess it just didn't feel right. So I refused to go back to that counselor. And really from 16 to 20, I just kind of did my best, right? I, you know, kind of tried to pretend that the abuse wasn't a big deal, but, yeah, I was a very volatile teenager. There was that duality that we actually see a lot of times with survivors where, like, I was doing really well in school and I had a fairly good social network and friends and activities and things. I worked a part-time job and then a full-time job even in high school. And then, but on like the internal level, I was suicidal. I was depressed. I was acting out sexually. I didn't have any boundaries. I was taking really huge risks in my life. So when I started dating my partner, I met him when I was 18, and it became clear to me really quickly that I did not know what I was doing. And he began reflecting for me very quickly, like, something's up, you need help. And so while he later, you know, added on more layers of abuse, in that instance, he, you know, was helpful in helping me begin to get the courage to really face what was going on.
That's an interesting contradiction.
Isn't it?
Yeah. Trying to figure that one out.
Yeah.
As I'm sure you tried to figure it out as well.
Oh my gosh. Yeah. It is. And, you know, I think this is actually, it is a parallel for me around how abusers show up in the lives of victims, because my grandfather was a friend and a companion and someone who I enjoyed spending time with, and we laughed and goofed off, and he was someone who was harming me. And it was very much the same with my ex-husband, where, you know, we had really beautiful moments of connection and joy and love, and there was real harm also going on. And I think that, you know, not to digress too much, but this is a really interesting piece of the puzzle for me as survivors, as a survivor and in working with survivors, because finding a way to come to a place of peace about that, right? And dealing with those mixed emotions that we might have in the way of, like, I love this person, and how can I love this person? Because they hurt me. Aren't I supposed to hate them?
Yeah.
And so one of the things I really enjoy in working with my clients is exploring that and coming to a place of understanding that they really are both, right? And on one hand, they are someone who's harmed you. And on the other hand, they're someone that you love. And it's okay actually to have that dualistic feeling or, you know, kind of relationship to the person who's harmed you.
Yeah. You mentioned your work with clients, and I have to comment on having explored your website. You have such wonderful testimonials there, kind of video clips of of happy clients. And, you know, so
I congratulate you
on that. Yeah, that's a real accomplishment.
Now, oh, I appreciate that. Yeah,
one of the things that I'm interested in is I note you have a master's degree in counseling psychology, and yet you seem to be flying under the flag of coaching than counseling / therapy. What's that about?
So when I'll kind of jump back to the story where I was started to see, we'll bring it back in. So I started to think, okay, how do I want to really move forward? What's next in my life? And I was starting to kind of do some healing work that was on this different level of like, how do I actually change these behaviors? What do I need to learn? What do I need to know? What skills do I need that I missed growing up because I was trying to manage all this abuse stuff? And so that was coming together as I was deciding to start my master's in counseling psychology. So I was
Where did you go, by the way?
Oh, Golden Gate University here in San Francisco.
Okay, great.
Mm-hmm. And so I thought, well, okay, I have these ideas that are kind of, you know, trickling out of me that I'm trying to capture in the way of like a book or a guide or something. And I also know that I need some background, more background on all of this. So I was actually starting my business and starting my master's at the same time. And so it's always the Rachel way. I'm like, always make it harder on myself than it needs to be.
So your business being your work as a coach.
Yeah. And I went into my master's program thinking that I would become a therapist, right?
Yeah.
But as I started to listen in on kind of the modalities and the approaches, certainly some of the, like the diagnosing pieces, like all of that wasn't resonating with me. And I also was kind of like, you know, I might end up in jail if I become a therapist because I'm such a rule breaker, you know, that, I don't know. Because one thing that I was really noticing I was doing some volunteer groups where it just kind of a peer-led, very gentle, kind of using a different person's book to kind of explore healing. And I noticed that when I would share like my own story and a bit of what had worked for me or something that had made a difference, the feedback I kept getting from those women was like, oh, like that's so helpful to be able to see kind of the where you were and the where you are now. And so all of these bits and pieces came together to really help me make the decision of finishing my master's in counseling psychology, but not going on to do the licensing as a therapist because I really wanted to work in this coaching modality. I wanted to work from the place of kind of solution. And not to say that you don't ever get solutions in therapy, but it's often a space and a great space, a needed space for people to explore and be heard and acknowledged and seen. But what I found that was really missing for me was the what do you do about it piece. And I felt that the coaching was going to give me a better pathway to explore that with people.
Yeah. You know, you actually, on your website, you give the rationale in what I thought was a very compact and beautiful way. And I guess as a licensed person, I have this little bit of a bias, right?
Yeah.
Everybody's got to do it the way that they got to go through what I had to go through. That's not my totally conscious attitude, but I know it's there.
Yeah,
So there's always this suspicion, well, are people becoming a coach to avoid, you know, jumping through the hoops that you have to get licensed?
Yeah, it's a great question.
But what you wrote on your website, and I'd like to bring it up and just kind of prompt you a bit, or I'll read from it or something here. It really put my mind to rest in that regard. And what I love is you've got a two-column chart.
Yeah.
On one side is labeled coaching. The other side is labeled therapy. And so I'll just kind of read down that. You characterize coaching as action-oriented versus therapy, which is thought-feelings-oriented. Mm-hmm. And then you've got a section called tools. And on coaching, we have the tool of inquiry. And on therapy, we have listening. I'm not sure what the difference is. Yeah, what's the difference that you're getting at there between inquiry and listening? Yeah.
So inquiry really means that I'm going to be asking tough questions. I'm going to be asking questions that are meant to drive you. Whereas listening in therapy is more in the space of more in that world of like holding space for someone and not necessarily directing the conversation.
So you're going to be very active as a coach.
Yeah, that's it.
Very directive and active. Mm-hmm. Continuing with that chart under coaching, you've got accountability versus in therapy, reflecting. Mm-hmm. And so again, that's kind of got that action dimension implied there. And under coaching, you've got requests. Under therapy, you've got confronting.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Talk a little bit about the difference there between
Between request and confronting.
Yeah.
So the request is really in the world of here's what I want you to now go do. Right? Mm-hmm. I'm going to teach you this skill. And now my request is that you go out and you do this and you do this and you do this. Right? And of course, my clients have choice all along the way. So it's not like it's a, you know, it's like a, you know, an oligarchy here where I'm like demanding, but I am setting up more of a frame, right? Yes. And more of a context for them.
Okay.
Whereas in therapy, that confrontation is, I think of therapy as kind of gently nudging people, but not necessarily, making a clear request about what their next step should be.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
So you're kind of leading people and supporting people in their self-reflection, and they may from that place make some decisions about something that they want to do or choose or take action on. But again, it's a little bit less of that directness that I think is there. And, you know, some of that's changing, to be quite honest. A lot of therapists actually these days are starting to bring in coaching modalities, and they're working from kind of dual platforms. So for me, the distinction these days is a little bit more along the lines of what the goal is for the participant or for the client, right? So I really think of healing as three stages, you know, victim, survivor, and then what I call beyond surviving. Other people might call it thriving or, you know, other words. But I think of therapy as the really safe space for that survivor stage when you're coming out of the denial of it and you're beginning to acknowledge that something happened to you. Mm-hmm. And you need a safe space where you can talk about that and you can be heard and seen. And in fact, you're not ready to be nudged and pushed or made request of, right? Because you're still in that process of really taking on the experience. And then I love, you know, coaching for that next stage where we're going to get a little bit more into the, okay, so here's the problem. Here's why it's a problem. But now here's what we're going to do about that.
Yeah, yeah. Well, just to wrap this chart up, you've got two other pairs. You've got strategic planning versus diagnosing. You already shared your misgivings about diagnosing. And then you've got telephone and email versus special time and place as being more characteristic of therapy. And just to finish this up, I like the paragraph that you write on your website. I'll read that. Since this is a coaching program and not therapy, this means that every single session ends with, okay, now this week, go out and practice this skill or tool rather than, our time is up. See you next time.
Yeah, being a little disparaging there, aren't I?
Yeah. Just a little bit.
I promise, I love therapists. I really do.
Okay. And you said this, you go on to say, this was one of my biggest frustrations with therapy. I felt like I spent weeks and weeks talking, but not getting anywhere. To be sure, therapy is an important part of the journey, but if you're done just talking about what happened and are ready to do something about it, then this program is for you. So you really, right from the outset there, you kind of challenge the potential client. You're letting them know, okay, yeah, I'm going to be demanding some things of you, and you're going to really need to be committed to do it.
That's right. That's right. Yeah, and along the way, that's been a big part of my learning and my process is determining where people are. I've certainly misstepped, as we all do in this world of, you know, supporting others in their journey, and have brought people into the program who really needed to spend some more time in therapy. And so as soon as I noticed that, of course, you know, we backed up and we came up with adjustments and alternative kind of approach. But the Beyond Surviving program, I think what is distinct about it is it's a curriculum, right? So whereas I think when we go into therapy, we get to kind of, as the client, we get to kind of lead the conversation a bit more and say, you know, this is what's on my mind today, or this is what's up for me. And again, that's really important and of high value at a certain stage in healing. But when people come into my program, sometimes they're a little surprised that we're going to be looking at specific lessons. We're going to be taking a very specific, like, journey, right? We're going to work through a curriculum. So I think that's a key distinction between kind of coaching, at least coaching the way that I do it. Not all coaches have a program like I do, and therapy. And again, I think it's just both of them are very valuable and very important. You know, when I look back, like that time in therapy for me was brilliant. It was actually extremely healing and helpful. It's just that it hit a point where it stopped being, and I had to figure out, well, what's the next step? What's the next thing?
Yeah. Good for you. And you refer to your program as Beyond Surviving.
Mm.
Can you unpack that a little bit more for us?
So I was working through a conference, actually a training that I was in, and the intention of that particular retreat and program was to develop a social program, something that we could take out into our communities that might make a difference or have a social impact. And I had this idea of creating a conference and bringing men and women who had been through abuse together to talk about their experiences and how do you heal. But I was really stuck on a name for the conference. And I was, you know, kind of tossing this around with another guy in the program. And he was asking me about, you know, well, why do you even want to do this conference? What about it is important to you? So I shared with him my story, and when I finished talking, he says, "Oh, Rachel, like, you know, it's just so amazing that you've been through all of that and you've survived so much, and that you've gotten by and gotten through." And I don't know, but that day something just kind of like flipped in me, and I got so upset by that. And I was like, you know what? I am so sick of this, you know, talk about being a survivor. Who wants to be a survivor? That's like, oh, you know, terrible. I don't want to just survive my life and white knuckle it through. And I really want to get beyond all of this. And that's it, just, you know, being light bulb. I was like, yeah, that's the idea. I want to be beyond surviving. I want to be, you know, living my life. I don't want to be in this place where I'm constantly managing the past or having to adapt. And, you know, in the way that I think about it now, that's like 12 years later, you know, now as we're talking about it today from the time where I got the concept, is that Beyond Surviving isn't about never ever having a hard day. But Beyond Surviving is about two things. One, decreasing the frequency of how often you go into a trauma state or a trigger. And that those times become so few and far between that they're like little blips, right?
Yeah.
And also that you are equipped. You have a toolkit so that whenever life does happen or whenever something does come up for you, that you know how to respond, right? And you have the skills and tools to navigate rather than kind of this feeling of just not knowing where to start or where to begin that I certainly felt for most of my life. And I see that in my clients over and over again. Does that make sense?
Totally. Yeah. I can sense why you're as effective as you are, because you project so much energy and enthusiasm, you know, for the work and for the progress that you've been able to make. Where does PTSD come into this? Do you see that as a relevant concept, construct?
Huge. Yeah. One of the things that coincided with my master's work was in one of my courses, we were introduced to Dan Siegel's work, in particular, his book, The Developing Mind. Mm-hmm. And I think I read that book in 2 days. Like I just like ate it up because it was filling in so many blanks for me. And I started to really get curious about the brain. And what is happening on a neurological level when we experience trauma? And for me, the more I studied the brain and more I began to understand the impact of trauma on neurological processes, the more excited I became because I thought, oh, okay, this is, let me think about, instead of thinking about this as like a trauma or a disorder, let me think about this like it's a brain injury.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And just like if I had a broken arm, I would figure out, well, what are the steps for healing a broken arm? If I have a broken brain, right? What are the steps for healing a broken brain? And to my mind, PTSD is, you know, a process of misfirings, right? A process of the brain not being healed and whole as a result of trauma.
Okay.
And so the main like kind of functions in the brain become either overactive or numbed down, or, you know, kind of, I call it offline, even though that's not totally a fair characterization, but it helps people kind of get the gist of what's going on. And so I see in my clients, absolutely, PTSD symptoms. And while I don't, you know, again, diagnose anyone, I can see the behaviors that are there that are, you know, PTSD behaviors and symptoms and reactions. And so, you know, in the work that we do, it's actually the very first kind of module of the program is teaching people how to retrain their brain, understand their nervous system, understand what's happening when they're triggered so they know how to intervene and interrupt that process so they can stop flashbacks, so they can stop going into panic attacks, et cetera.
Yeah. What about the shame and guilt that most people who've been through sexual abuse go through? How do you approach that?
Well, so one of the things that about working with shame is making it super simple. So one, I think that's a concept that I really use throughout my program and throughout my work is trying to take things that seem really big and what I call kind of like spaghetti brain, like it's just all these different things and like try to make it as super simple as possible. Mm-hmm. So there's some work that we do that leads up to working around shame. So some steps that we take, you know, reconnecting with our integrity, reconnecting with our sense of self, beginning to connect with our higher genuine self, even though people in these early stages of the program do not believe any of that stuff. And that's okay. I tell them that, right? We're not worried about believing this. I just want you to connect to like who you might actually be instead of all of this, you know, other stuff that you've come to believe. And then teaching them how to, you know, process triggers, how to manage and respond to that, because we've got to have that foundation, right? Let me say it this way. If you are someone who's constantly getting triggered all the time and going into this loop of escalation on a neurological level, right? The amygdala is taking over, your nervous system is getting activated, and then you're doing your best to try to calm that back down. But if you're stuck in that loop, it's actually really hard to do any other healing work, to process something like shame or communication or trust. So that's why we spend amount of our time there. And then as we start to look at shame from those foundations, right, having those pieces in place, what we can begin to look at are three things, really, I guess. So the first are factors that are at play that prevent us from being able to stop or make choices about the abuse. I think one of the key reasons why we fall into shame is we think that there was something that we could have done about it, right?
Yeah.
We feel like we're to blame because surely I could have stopped it. Surely I could have spoken up. Surely I could have done something to make this terrible thing stop. So by first of all, taking a look at the factors that are at play that actually make that impossible, like age or dependency on the abuser or fear and manipulation that occurs. So once people kind of get that first piece of noticing how their choice was taken away, right? And therefore, yeah. How can they, then we can go into the next piece, which is really looking at, you know, the belief systems around it's my fault, there's something that I did, or there's something about who I am that caused this abuse, which all contribute to shame, right? And then I love taking people through a process where we really start to look at the simple definition of shame, which is believing that you are at cause for something or that you made the choice to make something happen. And so I take my clients through an exercise that helps them really see in very simple black and white how there's no way that they made the choice mm-hmm. around abuse. Mm-hmm. And therefore, it's not theirs. And if it's not theirs, they can't be to blame.
Yeah, wonderful.
And then shame just kind of goes away. Not to be silly, because being in shame is, you know, it's hard when you feel that, right? When you feel like you aren't good enough, and the impact of shame is we end up not taking care of ourselves. This is a huge reason why I was in a relationship for 10 years that was abusive, mm-hmm. right? Because my needs and desires didn't matter. And that's a direct result of being shame-based.
Right, right.
Yeah.
Yeah. I guess another spinoff might often be social isolation. Is that right? That people tend to isolate themselves. How do you get them past that?
Mm. So in the lesson on loneliness, we talk about the behaviors that we use that actually end up causing us to remain withdrawn and isolated. And we look at the belief systems that are most often at cause of that. There are some common ones. And then, of course, we work, you know, individually and see what comes up for people. But for me, you know, for example, I had a very strong belief that people were always going to leave me, right? Or harm me.
Mm-hmm.
So when you have a belief system like that, creating connections is kind of hard. Like, why would you do that? You know, it just doesn't make any sense to go forward and do that. And so, you know, we use some of the strategies that I teach for challenging false beliefs and kind of retraining the thinking, first of all, around that, looking for alternatives. But I think one of the things that has helped me the most and that I see helping my clients is looking at relationship and connection as a spectrum. Hmm. I think a trap that survivors fall into in many areas, and this is just one of them, is we get into that either or thinking, right?
All
it's
or
either,
nothing.
Right? It's either I'm fully connected with every single person, and it's like a deep and meaningful, and I tell them everything relationship, or I don't have any relationship at all, right? It's dumb, it's trite, it's not important. And so as I began to do this work for myself, I really questioned that. And I thought, well, what is driving the loneliness in my life? And why is it there? And that was a core piece of it, that either or, all or nothing thinking. And so as we begin to recognize that we can actually connect and relate to people on a lot of different levels, and relationship on all of those different levels is meaningful. It's beneficial. You know, the friend who you have like coffee with once a month and, you know, just kind of chat about, you know, what's happening in sports. And that friend who you see more often and you talk about your core like desires, needs, or fears, like both of those relationships are meaningful and are contributing mm-hmm. to the whole kaleidoscope that is your life.
Yeah, good point. Now, the abuse of trust, I would think, would be a really big issue in here. And how do you get people to a place where they can begin to trust others? Yeah.
So trust is something that we cover later on in the program. So one of the things that I have experimented with and tried to be very intentional about in developing the program is figuring out what I call kind of like the order of operations. So if we do this, and then this next step, that is going to produce the best results. If we try to put trust like early on, it just falls flat. We can't get anywhere, right?
Yeah, yeah.
So
a part of it, I would guess, as in therapy, is they're coming to trust you.
Yes, hugely. Yeah. That's right. Yeah. That's right. Yeah, very much so. So when we do the work around trust, we've built in a lot of other skills already. So, you know, kind of take that with the grain of salt here, you know, what I'm going to say about trust. For me, trust is really about the determination of how we trust, I think, is where people, not just survivors, people get messed up and get confused. Because what we most often do is we look to judge the character and quality of another person. But the criteria that we're using to do that is often very messy or ineffective. So, for example, we might determine that somebody is trustworthy based on the fact that they are able to do something or have a characteristic that we lack. And that seems like it might be good on the surface, but what it actually ends up doing is causing us to be a little bit blind and not take in the full picture.
Mm-hmm.
I'll give you a little example of that.
A hero worship. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, yeah, that is kind of it. It's like when I met my ex-husband, he had really good boundaries around sex, and I did not. And I thought, whoa, this guy isn't trying to get me in bed right away. Wow, he must be like amazing, right? You know? And so it was like I took that one piece, right, where he was doing, he had quite character and quality around something where I felt I did not. And I used that to determine that he was trustworthy. And so I gave him the green light or the check mark and said, okay, great, we're in. And I stopped looking.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know if I would have even known anyway, if I'd looked more at that age and where I was in my journey and all of that. But I certainly did not have a chance to experiment because I just said, okay. And then, of course, you know, he turned out to not be such a great guy. And I see this happen a lot in the lives of survivors is, you know, we make quick judgments about who's trustworthy. And then we're in it. And then that adds a whole new layer and we stay stuck, right?
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
So what I basically try to do with my clients is teach them new criteria, how to actually judge whether someone is trustworthy or not. And of course, underlying all of this is, do we trust ourselves? Yeah, like can we believe in our own, you know, our own judgment about something and our own abilities? Because if we don't trust ourselves, you know, trying to trust anybody else is kind of a non-starter.
Mm-hmm. Now, I see that you've got a book called mm-hmm. Beyond Surviving. I looked for it on Amazon. I couldn't find it there, so I assume this is...
Oh, it is on Amazon.
Oh,
you just have to type both the, you have to type both the title and my name or the full title, but it's there.
There are a lot it's available on Kindle Rachel, and paperback. Yeah, there are a lot of Rachel Grants on Amazon.
Yes. That's
so
right.
So I didn't look long enough and hard enough. So you've got a book, and I have the sense that... and you have a very defined program.
Yes.
With specific steps, as you've been telling us, and people can find out more about that on your website, which I think is rachelgrant.com. Is that right?
rachelgrantcoaching.com.
Coaching.com.
You almost had it.
Yeah. Okay, good.
Very
Rachel.
Close.
Yeah, so there's a lot of good information there. And mm-hmm. so it looks like, you know, you've got the book, you've got a program with very specific steps, and I gather you work one-on-one, groups, online, all of those?
Yeah. So I have a couple of different ways that people can explore working with me. The first is the 28-day boot camp for the brain online program. Mm-hmm. So that's really getting into some of those fundamentals around, you know, getting rid of PTSD, retraining the brain, building confidence, getting off of the roller coaster, kind of taking people through that process, the foundation. It's introductory. It's not going to solve everything, but it definitely helps people get out of those kind of trauma spirals.
So right? That's sort of like an automated program. They're not interacting with you directly, but they're following a lesson plan. Is that right?
That's right. They go through 8 circuits, and each circuit has an article, lesson, and reflections, a video training, and then a practice day. And they do receive support from me via email and via online office hours each week.
Okay. Uh-huh.
And then I also offer 4 groups a year for women. And I'd love to get groups for men going. So guys, if you're out there, like, come. I really want to like work with you guys more. I work with men mostly one-on-one these days, but I'd love to do a group program with men. It's just a matter of getting enough of them all together at the same time.
Yeah.
So I do 4 group programs for women each year. And then I also work one-on-one.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You know, it seems like you have got this so organized, a set of materials and so on, and a model, and you're also seem to be very much a businesswoman. I'm almost having the feeling that this could be franchised in some sort of way. Are you thinking about?
Oh, my goodness.
Maybe I shouldn't plant this idea. I mean, the franchise sounds like franchise maybe is not a good word, but
well, point in fact, I have written the facilitator's guide for the program.
Okay.
And I've trained a few people as facilitators of the Beyond Surviving program. Mm-hmm. So that's something that I'm kind of dipping my toe in. I'm still kind of trying to wrap my head around, like, what does that really look like? What are the parameters for all of that? But definitely I do have a thought and a vision towards that, because I'm just one person.
Yeah.
And I can only reach so many people, right? And support so many people each year. And so I would definitely love to have other people trained in the Beyond Surviving method, and so that they can use that, you know, with their clients.
Sure.
And so it's a people keep nudging me about this. So yes, I guess that may be my next adventure.
Yeah. It's just really seems like I can easily see that unfolding, because, you know, there are a number of other high visibility people out there, therapists who training eventually gets to the place where they're doing more training than they are actually seeing people themselves, because there is such a big need, you know, and there are lots of new therapists and coaches coming online all the time who are looking for for ideas and support and processes that they can engage with.
For sure.
Yeah. Does your approach work for other sorts of traumas other than sexual abuse? And have you done any work with people who are suffering from different sorts of trauma?
Yeah, that was a part of my journey in this, was people starting to come to me and say, well, I haven't experienced this, but I've experienced this, and can I do your program? And so, you know, in the early days, I said, sure, I don't know if it's going to work, but let's try.
Well, that's good. You were honest.
You know, yeah. And so now, you know, years and years later, I've worked with people who've experienced physical abuse, emotional abuse, narcissistic abuse, bullying, absent mother, neglect. And so the processes, with some adaptation here and there, but generally speaking, trauma is trauma. And so the way that we can heal from that, can be very similar. And so, I've had the great joy of working with people with all, I know that sounds so strange for me to say it that way, right? I've had joy working with people from all sorts of different abuse, but I'll say it this way. I am excited and happy to see that the work applies to those different experiences and has a positive effect. And those people have been able to heal from the trauma and abuse they experience, just as those who have experienced sexual abuse.
Yeah, yeah, good for you. And I can see that. A guest that I spoke with recently had said something along the lines that it seemed to him that just about all of the people who come in for therapy suffer from childhood trauma,
mm-hmm.
or yeah. a form of PTSD that's not generally acknowledged as such,
which
begins to sound a little bit like Freud, you know?
Right.
That everybody suffers from some kind of a sexual trauma.
Right. Right.
Well, as we wind down here, I wonder if there are any other closing thoughts that you have or anything that you wanted to get across that you didn't get a chance to.
Well, whenever I have the opportunity to speak to folks, so if you're listening and you're somebody who's been through abuse, I just want to make sure that if nothing else from today, you really hear that this is not a life sentence. That this experience of trauma and abuse is an experience and it's had an impact and it can be healed and you can really reclaim your life and move forward and you don't have to remain stuck with all of that is there because of those experiences. And you can really go on to live a life that you love and to have more good days than bad. And of course, if there's any way that I can support you in that, I'm here. So there's lots of free resources on the website. And there's, of course, working with me more formally. But even just shoot me an email to connect and touch base. Anything that I can do to support you along the way, I'm happy to.
Well, Rachel Grant, that is a great closing message. One of hope and optimism for folks out there who may be in pain and suffering. Mm-hmm. So I want to thank you for being my guest today on Shrink Wrap Radio.
Thank you. It's really been a lovely time. I really appreciate it.
I felt really energized by this conversation with Rachel Grant, despite the seriousness of the topic. I very much admire her authenticity. Clearly, her approach to dealing with sexual abuse springs from her own experience and original thinking. She's chosen to follow her own path, and from that place of authenticity, she's able to inspire others to walk it with her. I think the Beyond Surviving curriculum she's developed makes a lot of sense and is stated simply enough that it's within reach of any reasonably motivated clients. Clearly, she's also a motivated businesswoman, and I do think the model and materials she's developed will evolve into a powerful training program for other coaches and therapists. As usual, if you decide to order her book, I encourage you to use the Amazon widget in the right-hand sidebar on our website.
Hello, fellow Shrinkwrappers. I have a couple of questions for you. Do you think that Dave is doing a good job? Well, I do anyway. And do you wish for him to continue producing these podcasts? I sure do. So, are you willing to support him? I just did. It's easy. Go to the Shrink Wrap Radio website. Click Support on the top menu. Select the amount you wish to contribute. If you have a PayPal account, enter your credentials. If you don't have a PayPal account, you can still do one-time donations by just entering your credit card details. PayPal will take care of the rest, David will be happy, and we will all get the benefit of his excellent guests and his well-honed interview skills. Now to my last question. When will you do it?
When indeed? I hope your answer is now, and that you agree with Sven in Sweden and will join him in helping to support Shrink Wrap Radio financially. Lest you think there are just scads of people supporting my efforts here, I can tell you that there have been no new donors since the last podcast, and not many in the preceding podcasts just before that one. Last time I mentioned that I had lined up author Ayelette Waldman, who's written a book about her experiences microdosing psychedelics titled A Really Good Day. Well, I thought I had her locked in, but she got back to me saying her schedule is too full right now. She suggested I try again some months from now, and I will do that. In the past, you've heard me say that I turned down many opportunities to do sponsored ads on this podcast. The entity that I feel best about advertising is Shrink Wrap Radio because I believe in what I'm doing and believe this work should be supported. However, I now want to take the opportunity to make an unpaid endorsement of a web design company that has been an invaluable resource in helping me keep our website up and running for a number of years now. I'm referring to Quan Web Studios. Steve Post heads up the team there, and they are a full-service digital marketing agency. Years ago, they converted my old HTML-based Shrink Wrap Radio website to the WordPress version you see today. In addition, Steve and his crew have helped me with a number of web challenges over these past years. I'd probably be out of business if it weren't for their expertise and generous help. Their pricing is more than fair, and they've always been extremely responsive. The website is www.quanwebstudios.com, and Quan is spelled Q-U-A-N. As I said at the beginning, this is an unpaid endorsement. I just wanted to do it out of gratitude for their support and also to turn you on to a good thing. Finally, I'm sorry to report the death of Dr. Jack Panksepp, who was my guest on Shrink Wrap Radio episode number 329 on the emotional foundation of mind. His work was so seminal that I always had it in the back of my mind that I would be interviewing him again. Sadly, that won't be possible. I found him to be a wonderful guest, at once at the top of his field, a consummate scientist, as well as a humble, accessible, open-minded human being. I learned of his passing through my good friend, Matthew Dolitz, of The Neuropsychotherapist. Let me read what Matthew posted there. I quote, "We are saddened to learn that the neuroscientist, psychobiologist, and author Jack Panksepp has died from cancer on April 18 at his home in Bowling Green, Ohio. He was 73. His groundbreaking research in neuroscience has been pivotal in the field of affective neuroscience, a field which he helped create. He helped reveal the biological underpinnings of emotion, and his theories opened new possibilities for the treatment of depression and other mental illness." You can find obituaries in the Washington Post and the Toledo Blade to get more details of his life. His book, The Archaeology of Mind, Neuroevolutionary Origins of Human Emotions, was published by W.W. Norton and Company, and it provides a foundation for contemporary affective neuroscience. Close quote.
Hi, everyone. This is Rachel Grant, sexual abuse recovery coach, and you're on the couch with Dr. Dave.
And of course, that was today's guest, Rachel Grant, once again. And I think with that, we'll wrap it up for today. You can send your emails to shrink@shrinkwrapradio.com. You can leave comments about individual shows in the comments area on the site. You can leave voicemail on our message phone at 415-830-4014. Or you can use our app to leave a message, a voicemail message. And you can find out all about our app on the website under the Apps tab. Thanks to today's guest, Rachel Grant, MA, for sharing her work in sexual abuse coaching. My guest next week will be Dr. Cheryl Fuller on a Jungian understanding of the fat complex. We'll be discussing her book on that topic, which is titled The Fat Lady Sings, A Psychological Exploration of the Cultural Fat Complex and Its Effects. So until then, this is Dr. Dave saying, it's all in your mind.
You've been shrink-wrapped by Dr. Dave. All the psychology you need to know, and just enough to make you dangerous.